One side effect of lockdown measures around the world is the effect they've had on animal behaviour. It didn't take long for emboldened wild animals to venture into locked down cities, like the wild pumas, for example, that roamed the deserted streets of Santiago in search of food, or the herd of goats that took over an empty town centre in Wales. Wild deer, raccoons, turkeys and other creatures were spotted in urban settings that they might normally avoid. Back in the 19th century, though, it was common to see all kinds of animals on the streets of Dublin. To talk about this, I'm joined now by historian Juliana Edelman, author of the book Civilised by Beasts, Animals and Urban Change in 19th Century Dublin. Juliana, you're very welcome to the History Show.
Thanks for having me, Miles.
Now, we've seen a lot of examples of animals taking back human spaces while the world is in lockdown, but back in the period that your book covers, animals were a big part of everyday city life. What type of animals are we talking about?
Oh, all kinds of animals, from the domestic animals we associate with a farm, pigs, cows, chickens, sheep even at the market, and horses, of course, for transport and work. And then all kinds of pets, you know, from exotic, you know, people keeping a pet monkey to the ordinary cats and dogs. And then, of course, all the wild animals that we still see today, large amounts of bird life and foxes and things like that as well.
And I suppose something that you don't want to see very much nowadays, rats as well. There would have been plenty of those, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Although, interestingly, it's not really until they're concerned about rats as a cause of disease that rats are just kind of accepted as part of city life. So they're very concerned about rats causing problems with pipes and drains by chewing through things or problems in the house. But they're not maybe quite as obsessed with their eradication until they're linked to plague later in the century.
So give us a sense of the amount of animals like pigs, cows and sheep that were actually kept in the city as opposed to being brought into the city for slaughter or what have you, and how people managed to keep them in an urban environment.
Somewhere around 7,000 to 8,000 horses, you know, fluctuating, went up when the horse trams were at their peak, probably, and then started to decline towards the end of the 19th century. Thousands of cattle, they're a little bit harder to keep track of because, as you already suggested, you know, the rhythm of the market, there would be extra thousands for the weekly market. And then there would be lots of dairy cows, probably somewhere in the region of 3,000 dairy cows on any given day. But they also had rhythms. So during the spring and summer, they might be sent out of the city to graze. Sheep were just passing through, basically, for slaughter and at the market. People would have kept hens. And probably the most surprising animal, because we don't think of it as an animal that we certainly keep in cities now, is pigs. And there would have been huge numbers of pigs. So in the peak year that I looked at, there were about 12,000 pigs kept in the city. And these were kept all over the city. So they were in large lots, you know, basically as part of a bacon making business. But they were also kept individually in people's homes. You know, sanitary authorities were very concerned about people keeping an individual pig actually in the rooms with them, in the same way that we saw that kind of discourse around keeping pigs in the house in rural areas as well. That was also an urban phenomenon.
And were cows, for example, being milked in the city of Dublin in the 19th century?
Oh, yeah, they were being milked in the city of Dublin into the 20th century. First of all, milk was a really important food for everyone, for all levels of social class. It was recognized as a particularly nutritious food. And without refrigeration, you know, you didn't want your milk coming from miles and miles away, becoming sour or growing lots of lovely germs, as they later understood. And so city town milk, as it was called, was a reasonably common phenomenon. And even when they had, you know, longer supply chains and they could keep the milk cool, there was some concern that the sanitary condition of that milk was not necessarily improved just because it was coming from a rural area. And that, in fact, there was a lot of supervision, however loose it was, of dairy yards in the city. And so some people actually preferred to continue getting city milk because they trusted that the sanitary authorities were, you know, trying to keep it clean. Although there were all kinds of outbreaks of disease linked to milk because Milk is a very good medium for growing germs in. So you drop some nice germs into the milk and they say, woohoo, lots of food here. And so typhoid, which was later understood to be a bacterial disease, grew very nicely in milk. So if somebody had dirty hands and milked your cattle, then that milk was going to be contaminated.
What about birds? Was there more bird life in the city than you would see today?
Probably there was. One of the reasons would have been that there was more insects for them to eat, because when you have a lot of slaughterhouses, you also have a lot of flies and a lot of maggots. And so that attracts birds because it's feeding season for them. I have seen in a book on the natural history of London in particular that the population of wagtails, which are those little black and white birds that, you know, they do exactly what it sounds like, their little tail goes up and down, actually declined after the slaughterhouses left because there were less maggots for them to eat. So probably there were more birds even than we experience now.
Now, there are remnants, I suppose they're almost archaeological remnants, really, of how animals were part of the city life all around the capital. Tell us about some of those.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you would see it in all kinds of things, from the most obvious, you know, the boot scrapers by the side of doors to scrape off the muck from the streets, which would have included a lot of manure, to the names of streets, to anything like the incline of streets and the turns of roads would have been made to accommodate horses and carriages initially, because you know, a horse has limitations in terms of how much weight it can pull going up at a particular angle up a hill. So it would have been important to take that into account, or if you didn't want to have accidents of, you know, horses swinging carriages around too tight corners. And so some of the streets were changed in order to, you know, avoid those kinds of problems. Most of the lanes behind any kind of Georgian era or early 19th century housing are stable lanes, because most of those big houses, you know, you look around the big squares in particular, so Marion Square or Fitzwilliam Square or Mountjoy Square, you know, all around behind those large Georgian houses would have been lanes for keeping your horses, because that was your form of transport. And you see the arches now, they're particularly nicely preserved in a few houses on Henrietta Street, for example. Behind those houses would have been where you kept your horses, your maybe your stable hand lived above where the carriage and the horses were kept. And then actually, as people abandoned using carriages and horses, they were often turned into housing. So where the horses had lived, poor people tended to live.
And was animal welfare taken seriously in the 19th century and early 20th century?
There was a growing movement which very much was influenced by what happened in England. And there were some Irish politicians involved in the initial prevention of cruelty to animals legislation, Humanity Dick Martin, who was an MP from Galway. But the society that they tried to start in Dublin, that was to be a sort of sister society to the London Society, took quite a while to get off the ground. It was not initially supported by many people. And essentially, they had people who sort of wandered around the streets looking for examples of cruelty. And most of those examples had to do with handling cattle or horses, because that was the vast majority of animals you could see on the street. A lot more crimes relating to cattle in Dublin than in London, because there were more cattle, you know, proportionally. So yeah, there was a movement. It just didn't take off quite until kind of later in the century.
And was there a lot of cruelty to, you mentioned cattle, but also, for example, to horses?
There certainly was behavior that we would definitely consider by modern standards to be cruel. I mean, I think it's hard to understand the attitude towards a horse, although we saw similar attitudes in a way in the recent controversy over Gordon Elliott. You know, the horse was a machine for moving stuff around. And so when your machine was about to collapse, you didn't, you know, feed it up and pet it. You tried to get it to go one more time again, basically.
Of course, the major tragedy that happened during the 19th century, the middle of the 19th century, was the famine. And we know there was a huge influx of people from rural Ireland to Dublin in particular. How did that change the agricultural life of the city, if you like? Did they bring animals with them?
It's hard to say, but it does seem like certainly some people maybe brought with them the habit of keeping, in particular, a pig. And not so much during the famine years, because people didn't have any money and they sold their animals. But you can see with other waves of migration that the pig numbers do seem to kind of fluctuate in some relationship to that. you know, the immediate effect of the famine was for people, including people in the cities who were poor and keeping a pig to sell those animals or to slaughter them and eat them. And really the big effect of the famine on the city, I'd say, is in terms of the overall boost to the cattle trade, the livestock trade that happened in the country as a whole, and Dublin's kind of role within that trade.
And then when it comes to exotic animals, you had the establishment in 1831 of the zoological gardens. How did that come about?
Yeah, so again, like the SPCA, you know, Dublin is looking to London and wanting to kind of be on par with other metropolises. They found this zoological society immediately with the idea of creating a gardens, not just giving lectures about animals. And it's really one of the earliest zoological gardens in the world. You know, there's one in Paris, which is not quite the same idea. It's not initially thought of as a public park. They get a site of land from the Lord Lieutenant in the Phoenix Park, and they begin getting gifts initially from London. And it's really seen as a kind of a statement about Dublin's importance and its imperial connections, even from the outset.
Did they know how to look after these animals?
Not really. They accepted a certain amount of mortality. One of the saddest things is the rate of tuberculosis, which spreads among animals who are kept close together, trying to avoid the problems of the weather. A lot of them are kept in tight indoor spaces as well. So there's high death rates. But, you know, they do get better at it over time, and they do hire specialist keepers. But no, they're not super great at taking care of them at the start.
And did everybody have access to Dublin Zoo? Could everybody afford to go and visit Dublin Zoo?
From the outset, they seemed to have the idea of a kind of much more elite space as the zoo had kind of developed in London. But pretty rapidly, they run out of potential people who want to join as annual members. And there's a number of members of the committee who are really interested in enticing the working classes to the zoo as a way of, you know, rational recreation, improving kinds of amusements that would be better than the public house. And so they start these penny days on Sundays, and they're immensely popular, and most people could afford a penny amusement. So, you know, within 10 years of its foundation, it's really a much more mixed social space than a lot of kind of entertainments in Dublin.
Now, one of the characteristics, particularly of 19th century Dublin, was slaughterhouses. There were a lot of them. At what point did the municipal authorities decide this was not a good idea to have slaughterhouses all over the place? We're going to need to get rid of these. When did that happen, and what happened as a result?
So around the middle of the 19th century, when you start having corporate reform and the corporation takes over more public health duties, they start looking at slaughterhouses as one of the big contributors to public health problems. Essentially, what they do is that they hire members of the Dublin Metropolitan Police to act as sanitary inspectors. And it's not just slaughterhouses they're inspecting, but they spend a large proportion of their time inspecting slaughterhouses. And they're essentially, the slaughterhouses are required to get a license, and you're supposed to have some level of sanitation in order to get the license in the first place. And then these police officers go around trying to check up on them to make sure that people who don't have a license are not slaughtering, to make sure your slaughterhouse is clean. In reality, that system is far from perfect, not least of all because police officers and butchers are sort of in a similar kind of social milieu. So whether they're trying really hard to get people to comply is one question. Another issue is that the corporation is kind of more interested in policing the ones that are there and keeping them there than it is in reducing them. So what other cities had tried to do was to set up a public abattoir and force the slaughterhouses to close and use the public abattoir. And then you can inspect all your meat in one place and your streets are not full of the results of slaughtering animals. But actually in Dublin, they pick a piece of land, which people who are familiar with the geography of Dublin is right across from where the cattle market was. And it's outside of the North Circular Road. It's just across the street. There was actually an underground tunnel between the abattoir and the cattle market. Now both the cattle market and the former abattoir site are public housing. But the abattoir was outside of the city boundary. So the butchers basically made a legal case that they didn't have to use it. So in fact, it takes a very long time for that system to come in place. And up until then, they're just basically walking the streets, trying to make sure that people are whitewashing and cleaning and throwing their waste down drains and not heaping up manure in the yards.
So 19th century Dublin, lots of horses pulling carriages, lots of cattle, lots of slaughterhouses. It must have smelt awful.
Yeah, and don't forget the pigs and the chickens. So, yeah, I mean, I think to our senses, it must have been terrible. And it, I mean, I always think of the huge complaints over the River Liffey as a source of bad smells, you know, when the tide was low and the waste, and apparently people threw their dead pets in there and all kinds of things. So it really stank. But I always wonder, how could they distinguish that stink from the rest of the stink? And I think they were just so accustomed to the smell of the animals. That was just in a way that I don't think we could even imagine. That was just part of the landscape of the city.
Juliana, thank you very, very much indeed for sharing those odours with us. We'll have to leave it there. Juliana's book is called Civilized by Beasts, Animals and Urban Change in 19th Century Dublin. It's published by Manchester University Press. Juliana Edelman, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thanks.